Welcome to the Queer Movie Podcast, celebrating the best and worst in LGBTQ plus cinema, one glorious genre at a time. I'm Rowan Ellis, and welcome to one of our guest specials. Today, we're joined by a very special guest who will be answering the question, what movies made you queer? I am very excited to welcome Kristen Randall. Woo!
Thank you.
I sometimes do my own little intro, sometimes I get the guests to intro them, but you are an author and your publisher's bio for you on the website was such a delight. I was like, I'm simply going to read that verbatim. Queer, fat, neurodivergent author of queer, fat, neurodiverse books. When they're not writing joyful stories for the next generation of geeky gay kids, you can find them working at their local library branch or at home planning all the D&D campaigns they'll run one day. They swear the No Girlfriend Rule is her debut novel. Woohoo!
Hi.
Clap. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here. This is going to be just so much fun.
So I have literally, I can see it, but it's over the other side of my room because I'm obviously always prepared, a copy of your book. I'm so excited to read it, to get into it. The cover alone is an absolute delight because it's just two adorable looking queer teens in front of what looks like an artist alley at a Comic Con. And that to me is the ultimate front cover of a book that says, Rowan, you will enjoy this.
Yay, good. Yeah, Simone Blocker, the illustrator for it, was just, she nailed the girls. She nailed Hollis and Annie. And yeah, absolutely wild that this gets to be my debut cover. It's gorgeous.
So the way that this particular kind of episode works, if people who are listening haven't listened before, is that we talk to the very special guest about movies that had an influence on them. And sometimes these episodes get a bit deep. Sometimes they're just very fun and silly. A lot of the time, if we have any bisexuals on, they mention The Mummy, simply a or Pirates of the Caribbean. Truly a bi-awakening for so many. So it's really fun when we get guests who revisit things that other people have also mentioned and have some really out there things that you don't even think of as being queer or who are wanting to celebrate the more quintessential queer stuff. It's just a very fun time and hopefully you'll come away with some recommendations and or be nodding fervently as you're listening, like, wow, I feel very called out. So the first question that I want to ask, however, is the fact that we sort of use queer within the title of these particular episodes as a sort of umbrella catch-all, but do you use any other particular words to describe your identities that might come into play today?
Yeah, so queer is a really good, comfortable umbrella term for me. I personally identify as bisexual. It's a word that I had to take back from my youth, and I'm really excited to be able to use it in a positive light now. And I'm also non-binary.
Amazing. So I have asked you to come prepared. I do not know what you have bought me, so I'm very excited to find out. You can pick any order for the particular movies or characters that you're going to bring. You can go with most to least hinged. You can go with the earliest one to the most recent one. You can curate as you will. So with that in mind, please let me know your first choice.
Okay, so we're going to start at the very beginning for me. You know how every kid has that movie that they watch over and over and over again?
Mm-hmm.
Mine was The Wizard of Oz. And I feel like that should have been an early indicator. I'm talking like when I was like 2, 3, 4, 5, I watched that movie so many times that the VHS cassette that we had of it, we had to replace it like 3 times.
Incredible.
Yes, right? So like very early on, I feel like was a friend of Dorothy from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like, I loved how glamorous it was. I loved how spooky it was and that it could be those things of the same. It was just full of like drama and wonderful. It was just great. And little Kristen was all about it. That's one that my family brings up a lot is, oh, we should have known about Kristen then. And I didn't really think about the why and what really resonated with me until really I was thinking about it for this podcast. And I think the quintessential queer vibe from Wizard of Oz for me was the ragtag group of found family friends that take this adventure. Yeah, so like that is something that I just love. The idea that you could just find these people who understand you, who have the same goals. It's inspired a lot of my writing. That's it. That's my favorite trope, ride or die, is found family, which I think is also quintessentially queer. So I started very young with The Wizard of Oz.
I mean, here's the thing. If there's anyone in the audience who's listening to you talk about a VHS tape essentially wearing out and are going, what even is that? How is it possible for a movie to wear out? I just download it from a pirated site, as I'm sure all of the cool young hip criminals do. You might also be confused about this Friend of Dorothy reference, which is an equally older reference, which is fantastic. And it's one that is has a lot of mythology around it, I feel like, some of which I genuinely haven't looked into how accurate the mythology is.
Yes.
But like, also part of me doesn't want to because it is so funny. So there's, for example, the idea that the Naval Investigative Service started to try and find this woman named Dorothy.
This mythical Dorothy, right?
Yeah, they assumed that she was like running a gay bar, or she was some kind of person who if they could get her, they could find all the identities of the homosexuals who were illegally in the Navy. And obviously a futile hunt because it was indeed in reference to The Wizard of Oz, and I guess specifically to do with Judy Garland being this kind of gay icon that
absolutely.
She was.
Yes.
Which I absolutely love. And you're so right that there is this found family element to The Wizard of Oz that you might not necessarily think about it in that way as you're watching, but that I do find with a lot of these movies, you come to it later or you examine things about it when you're older and you're like, what was it about that I was so interested in? And that is absolutely such a key one, especially like a real ragtag group of characters who are so different, and that the differences are very much highlighted within the narrative, right? Like they're each looking for a part of themselves that is missing, that they need to try and improve on, which is the narrative, like the idea of a narrative across a whole story of like someone is missing something and they find it by the end and that's the story, is like the foundations of Western storytelling. But the idea that they can make up for each other's lacks in some way, that if there is a part of you that you want to work on, that you might find someone within your found family who is able to support you through that and is able to encourage you, is such a nice element that I think is not necessarily talked about a lot with a movie that has so many other things going on in it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And what I really like about that element of the storytelling with this one is that all of those characters are worth bringing along individually, even though they have these things that they're working on. Like they're working towards a goal together. And I don't know, it really resonated with baby Kristen. And now looking back at it as adult Kristen, I'm still just like, okay, yeah, I get that. It's a theme that comes up in my writing over and over again. And just as a queer person, my found family is my family. I just really enjoy it.
Is that a movie that you say now as an adult? Is it one that you still return to?
Every now and then I get like in a little nostalgia mood and I'll have to watch like a comfort movie. And now and then that is one that I come back. I don't think I will ever watch it quite as much as I did when I was 3 and 5. But yeah, I still enjoy it a lot. The songs get stuck in my head periodically. It's just a comfort one that I come back to.
I'm also legally obliged to ask if you have seen Wicked.
I have not. I feel like such a... I know. I feel
a fraud.
Like I am a fraud. Even more so when you think both of my parents are theater majors. So I was born into this and I have not seen Wicked.
That's like the ultimate child rebellion. You're like, I'm not going to see Wicked, Mom and Dad. I'm my own person.
Yeah, both of my parents loved it. And it's not even for like, I'm going to stick it to my parents. It's just, it's not something that has ever come up on my things to do yet. Well, that's not even true. I definitely want to watch it. It's just not one that I have gotten into watching yet.
It's on the list. I mention it because I think that there is, if a production is brave enough to do it, gayer than The Wizard of Oz,
absolutely.
To be honest, in a lot of ways.
Absolutely,
a lot
yes.
of subtext in that one.
So I haven't seen the play or the movie that's coming, but I am familiar with the score and definitely have some feels about defying gravity and all of that. Yeah, absolutely.
And for good. Oh, an excellent choice. I love this as a first choice. I feel like I'm always really interested when people bring something from their childhood that they were really obsessed with and then later on it makes sense to them. Was this something that was making sense to you as you were discovering your kind of different queer identities? Or is this something that you went through that process, you figured yourself out, and then you were doing that retrospective look back and went, oh, I maybe should have clocked this.
Oh, it's definitely that. I was so clueless when I was figuring out my identity. I grew up, just for context, I grew up in the American South in the late 90s, early 2000s. So it was a very different world than the one we're living in now. Tennessee. Very conservative. I had no idea what was going on with myself, but definitely in my like late teens and early 20s when I was figuring things out, it was one of those moments of, oh, bless her heart. Yeah, of course little Kristen loved this movie. Of course little Kristen felt seen by this movie, even though it was like this big fantastical thing. And I could definitely look back and see, oh, okay, yes, this is a time I should have known I was queer.
I love that. If we move on to your next one, is this another one from childhood? Where are we going along your yellow brick road timeline?
That's a very good way to phrase that. Yeah. So this is my intro here. And then we get into my teen years because that's when I really started figuring things out. So these are all 90s throwback golden era of rom-coms that should have been gay.
Love that.
Do we want to move on to number two?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Romeo and Juliet, the 1996 film with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes.
The Baz Luhrmann one?
Yes.
Incredible scenes. Okay, so walk me through this reasoning.
Okay, I can still see it in my head looking back. I was sitting in the floor and my friend's sleepover, and we watched this movie for the first time. And I was like, I had this really just super cringe Shakespeare phase in like fifth and sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And so I was all gung-ho about watching this film. And then I was like, maybe not for me. This is too cool for me. And then Mercutio came into the ball in drag, lit whatever he had going on. That was for me. That was that was my first real brush with queerness on the screen. The first time that I had ever really encountered it as an idea. And I didn't even really fully understand it, but I was like, this is it. This is for me. Whatever is happening here, I want to be a part of it. This is the ball that I want to go to.
If there are any people listening who are from transphobic government agencies, we would like to clarify that seeing Mercutio in drag did not make Kristen non-binary. They were not influenced by the concept of drag existing, that they would never have got there otherwise. It was just a very helpful stepping stone support.
Yes, I had already had these feelings of not being fully a girl by that age. Like I've always known in my heart that I am non-binary. I didn't always have the words for it. But seeing that gender was something that you could play with, something that you could create and explore and change, was really revolutionary to late middle school or like early middle school Kristen, for sure.
I love that. I also, like when you were saying about 90s rom-coms, all these movies that should have been more queer, mm-hmm. how would you have liked to queer Romeo plus Juliet even more than we had with our darling Mercutio?
I mean, I would love to see Claire Danes opposite some other 90s teen queen. We're gonna get into Julia Stiles later, but Julia Stiles, Claire Danes, Romeo and Juliet, I would love to see. I would watch that 500 times right now.
Allow the bury your gaze for the purpose of queering Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. That is allowed. It's tricky because Baz Luhrmann is so camp already. Like, I know. That his whole deal is like so camp that you're like, Baz Luhrmann, why are you not doing more explicitly queer stuff? It gets to a point where it's kind of appropriation, Baz Luhrmann. Oh. You're engaging in the camp, you're like drowning in it, and yet you need to give the people what they want. No, I agree. I am like, I love Baz Luhrmann stuff. Like, I love things that just over the top and ridiculous and plush and thought about from a visual standpoint in a really interesting way. Mm-hmm. And that movie is so iconic and is such a, I feel like so many straight girls have this connection to that movie in that they watched it during high school and their giggling attraction to Leonardo DiCaprio was like a formative part of their sort of romantic and sexual awakening. And I think that's an injustice that they were given that and we weren't given the same with Julia Stiles. Now you've said that, I'm like, this is truly the one injustice through history that we should be rectifying. Make it happen.
She could have fully rocked that mid to late 90s Leonardo DiCaprio hair too, just saying. Like that would have been a full look. I'm right there. Like,
agreed.
Perfect.
He isn't the height of mask in that, but I do think you would, if you did it, you would have to have the butch femme dynamic too. Lit. That would be absolutely stunning.
I'm there. I'll watch it right now. Let's make it.
Not to bring another musical into it, but are you familiar with the musical Bear, a pop opera?
No, I need to. I'm missing out. I feel like such a bad gay right now. I need to dive deep into musicals.
So one of the things about queer musicals and queer films as well is that we seem to over-index on a play within a play dynamic. We're always putting on a play within the play. There's always a performance within a performance.
My book is like a story within a story. So yeah.
Exactly. This is what I was going to say, like that connection. So in Bear, it is that the high school, it's about two kind of closeted gay high school boys in a very sort of conservative Christian school. And they are involved in a production of Romeo and Juliet. And which obviously, not to spoil Bear, but similarly sad ending to this musical for these boys. But there is a lot of the original Shakespeare text is used as lyrics, and you see them do the Pilgrim's Hand scene together. And it's like really beautiful. There's a load of references that are just really stunning in these like love songs, which is really nice, as well as some like classic 2000s edgy Spring Awakening style storylines as well. But it is, I think there is something really like queer about the story within a story, and especially if we're talking about your book, the idea of the D&D story within a story, where you have people who are not just rehearsing someone else's script and finding that script relates to their life, but are playing a game in which they are able to improvise themselves and create characters themselves. How quickly was D&D something that you bought into your book? Like, was it there from the start? Or was it like, I have these nerdy characters, I need to figure out something. Oh, there is so much potential in D&D, like further down the line.
All right. So the true answer to that is that I just love D&D. And so that was there from the beginning. And I think that it's cool that we're talking about the story within the story, because that's what was exciting to me about this book idea, that it was this D&D story that we're telling within the framework of a larger story. And as you touched on, what I think is really magical about creating our own stories in this way, like we do within the context of a tabletop game, is that it gives you a safe place, not to spoil a major part of the book, but gaming gives you a place where you can safely explore your identity and play with your identity and hold it in your hands without even them being your hands. It's your character's hands that are exploring these things. And yeah, so that was there from the beginning. It was such a quintessential part of my learning about my queerness and being comfortable with myself that I was super excited to bring just a fraction of that magic to the page.
And it's one of the reasons why I think that, especially when we're talking about younger actors and actresses, that when you see, I feel like a lot of them will not be out, will play some kind of queer role, and there will be an element of that experience that bolsters their ability to be out or their identity or their comfort with themselves, especially when you go back retrospectively and after they've come out and interview them and talk about like the ways in which playing that role had an effect on them in some way. And it's one of the reasons why I think that policing who can play queer characters is not necessarily super helpful. I mean, we've also seen a bunch of people who, like my friend Alice, for example, Alice Oseman, who wrote the Heartstopper kind of comics and TV show, along with a bunch of other novels, who had queer characters within their stuff and then gradually realized their own queerness to various degrees. And that it was, oh, actually, yeah, I was using this as a way of writing about elements of my experience that I'm also, that in that writing was able to figure stuff out. Was there anything in the writing of your book that you were like, oh, this is something that I hadn't necessarily thought about myself, or like an experience that I'm now reflecting on because I'm doing it through these characters in the actual writing of it?
Yeah, so less so with this book specifically, but definitely before I decided maybe I could be an author, I have written as my little secret hobby since I was 13. And it very much started off in role-playing forums or fan fiction, which I think is in the same exploration family as things like Dungeons and Dragons and other tabletop games. And absolutely 100% exploring queer relationships, exploring like gender identity in my writing in my formative writing years, helped me contextualize my own identity and figure out my own identity 1,000%. I would not have been, I think that I like, honestly, I would not have learned about those parts of myself without exploring them first when I was like straight Kristen, quoting like flying quotes around that, like several 13 open quotes and 13 end quote. Because for me, storytelling in whatever form, whether it's film or actual writing stories, that is how I explore and contextualize my world. And absolutely, because I was able to explore queer characters before I myself figured out that I was queer, that was an essential part of the journey.
That's actually a question, bringing it back to Mercutio. Mercutio is a side character within this story, right? Yes. And I feel like that is the place that a lot of queer characters are relegated to. Was that something that you noticed as you were finding these characters that you related to or that you were thinking about, that they're either the lack of sort of leading main characters who you resonated with or the fact that they weren't necessarily having this like centralized romance story? Was that something that you were picking up on as you were, yeah, going through these kind of character discoveries?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that because of that sort of sidelined representation, I often felt like I couldn't be the main character of my own life. You know what I mean? Whatever I was up to, it probably wasn't worth the plot. I'm just like a fun little interlude. And I think in a lot of ways that was really like, it set me back a lot. But in now being able to write stories about queer kids and fat kids and neurodivergent kids and like having them be front and center, literally on the front of the book cover, front and center, has been a wonderful like healing journey to reclaim the space that we've been historically pushed out of.
Love that. Was there anything else about Baz Luhrmann's seminal and iconic Romeo plus Juliet that you wanted to bring up?
Really just that beautiful ball scene. And I am a big music nerd, and I think I can blame that movie specifically for that. That soundtrack, I stole the CD, the compact disc, of that soundtrack from my friend's older sister. I'm really sorry, Lauren, if you're listening. I apologize. And I listened to that CD nonstop. And it was the first time that I really connected music and storytelling and the power of a really good mixtape. And I feel like that is a quintessential part of my queer journey as well. I'm neurodivergent, and so sometimes I have trouble processing feelings on my own. And music has always been a really good sensory tool for me to get into the feelings and the vibes. And that, I think, was my first intro to truly understanding how important music can be to storytelling.
I feel like the loss of the mixtape hit the queer community real hard. It doesn't hit the same sending someone a Spotify playlist.
I know. There's a sneaky, maybe not so sneaky Spotify playlist in my book, a little hidden gem in there. But yeah, it's definitely not the same as being able to hand somebody I used to spend hours like curating an actual like list and like a CD and making like gutting old CDs that I had and making cover art and like just like I went to the max for all of my like definitely not girlfriends in high school. Yeah, it was a time.
Amazing. I would love for us to go on to your third pick. Are we staying with the sort of 90s 2000s era?
Yeah, I'm trash for the 90s and 2000s. I hope that is
okay. Oh no, that's entirely okay.
Okay, cool. And I have really been enjoying watching these in preparation for this. It has just been a joy to my soul in this very wonderful and stressful launch week that I've just had. And probably my favorite is this next one. I think my version of Pirates of the Caribbean and the Mummy, 10 Things I Hate About You.
Amazing. Yes, entirely.
As a bisexual, I knew that I was like, Heath Ledger is very handsome, but I was obsessed with Julia Stiles. I wanted to be her. I thought she was the coolest. She was this edgy, punk rocky kind of girl, and she was beautiful, and she had this great alternative style, and I just would cut her out of every magazine that I ever had her in. I wanted to know everything about her. And did not fully understand that at the time. But Julia Stiles and 10 Things I Hate About You is definitely my bisexual awakening.
So every time when we do these episodes, people will talk about the movies and we normally do a bit of an intro, but I was like, Wizard of Oz, everyone knows that. Mm-hmm. Romeo plus Juliet, it's Romeo and Juliet, everyone knows that. And 10 Things I Hate About You, there's a part of me that's like, surely everyone also knows that. Do I need to give you an introduction?
Everyone should. So it is like, in updated, just for those who aren't in the know, one, become in the know, and two, it is an updated Taming of the Shrew, where there is a very, like, pretty princess perfect sister, and then this edgy shrew of a sister cat, and it's about her wooing by a bad boy, like, the underdog boy.
It's very interesting. I mean, two for two on the Shakespeare retelling.
I know, but right? Also, I had a brand.
That whole era had really good retellings as movies, especially as teen movies. And I do think if were to have someone describe the Taming of the Shrew in the stereotypical like teen speak, you would essentially, that would be the plot. And it wouldn't be too far off. It's not that you're like, oh, we've taken Macbeth and we've had to make it into a high school, so the stakes have to be different. It's literally, what if we took the tropes of the high school movie where the popular guy had to trick the unpopular girl into dating him so that his best friend got a chance at the girl's sister? That's it. That's both of them. That's it. And I think it's such a fun element of these movies that if you didn't know the original, it wouldn't matter. It would still be an amazing movie. But then knowing the original, same with She's the Man, same with, I was about to say Emma, Clueless, these classical retellings in some way. Was this something that you were entirely enamored by the two leads and you to the point of not necessarily appreciating the film as a whole? Or was this very much I appreciate everything about this movie that just happens to have these two leads that I quite like?
That is a really tough question. And I think the answer is yes to both. The thing that I remembered that I had carried with me through my later teens and my adulthood is just absolutely the vibe of those two and how I wanted in on that. I absolutely was obsessed with that. It was definitely my bisexual awakening of, oh, okay, Heath Ledger is cute, but Julia Stiles, and I watched her in everything, though. It wasn't just like anything that she was in. She was in like, what is that silly dance movie?
Save the Last Dance.
She was in anything that she was in. Mona Lisa Smile, another wonderful like movie with a whole bunch of cool women that I wished were queer. Yeah, like anything she was in, I was just gobbling it up.
If anyone has not seen Save the Last Dance, I can highly recommend it. Even if specifically you Google Save the Last Dance Juilliard audition, because
oh my god,
that and The First Step Up are these two examples of these movies where at the time the chokehold that they had on especially girls at the time, who were like, the dancing in these movies is the best dancing anyone's ever done, and if I could just dance like that, I would have the world at my feet. Every boy that I fancy would be obsessed with me. My whole world would be better. And now as an adult, especially with access to actual like professional choreographers who are pushing boundaries on social media, all this kind of stuff, you watch the dances and you're like, it's almost embarrassing that I couldn't do those dances.
Yeah.
Like, it's embarrassing that I did not have the skills to do what is just a humiliatingly bad dance.
It's like you've had just some robot arm chops and like a serious face. Absolutely. No, that a chokehold is the exact word. I watched again that movie again, but anything she was in, I still, she's just still to this day,
Chef's
Styles is the most wonderful.
There is an element of her character as well that is, I don't know whether there was a resonance there for you as bisexual woman, where she also has this kind of energy of not being interested in boys.
Yes.
That there is this thing that I think a lot of lesbians can see themselves in and appreciate within her. But I think there's also like potentially an element for bi people, even if they aren't like necessarily, they aren't necessarily not attracted to men, but this element of having different kinds of attraction to different genders, or having this a more complicated relationship than just the stereotypical, I don't know, I just fancy everyone. I'd be totally in the opposite of Julia Stiles' character. I feel like there is something about that angry teenage discernment and figuring out your identity and inner strength that is also something that seems queer in a different ways.
Yeah. And I think much like Kat is the character in this story, and like a lot of the kind of alternative girl leads in teen movies in this time, that was the idea of not really caring what boys think, actively rebelling against this like traditional femme model, like with her sister Bianca wanting to do the prom thing. It, like that to me, I felt really seen by that. I felt really reflected in that, because I have always, again, had gender stuff going on. But yes, absolutely. Like in terms of like how I represent my gender, but definitely in terms of it's like, it's okay not to like boys. It's okay not to want to perform for boys all of the time. Felt really radical for me as a teen, for sure.
Amazing. Was there anything, like any particular scenes in this movie that stuck with you, either because of the particular ways in which you resonate with the characters or how hot and cool the characters looked during the scene? Both are valid.
Yes. Yeah. So I think you can't talk about 10 Things I Hate About You without talking about the poem scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, imagine this, an angsty, nerdy little writing kid at like when I was in my teens. And I wanted so badly for Julia Stiles to be confessing her feelings for me in that poem. And it was, I wouldn't say it's the first time that I really understood that that's something that you could do, but it was like, became this like aspirationally cool and like embarrassingly genuine ideal for me, like that you could use your word in a way that wasn't even all the way comfortable with you yet, that you could be so raw and cool and like daring and brave that you could use your words to have that moment. And I think that's something that I try to capture in my writing, just like being like painfully genuine sometimes.
I think that there is that, I can't remember what it's called, but it's the sort of graph of people who want to be creative in some way. So if, let's say writing, if you just decide that you want to be a writer, but you yourself have not necessarily engaged with other people's writing, then your confidence level is like sky high.
Yes.
And then as you learn more about writing, your confidence level plummets at a rate that is like faster than your growth as a writer can sustain.
Yeah.
And I feel like that way sometimes with things like that, where like the dream of, oh wow, what if I was a poet? Amazing scenes like that, and you're like, oh, that was so meaningful. And then you begin to write and you're like, oh no, this is really hard.
There is a reason I am not a poet, but I wrote some truly horrendous poetry around that age, which I think is also like a queer rite of passage, right? You've got to write all those big feelings down somewhere. And yeah, I never had my like cathartic say embarrassing things in front of the class kind of moment, but definitely put in my time in the bad poetry trenches.
Yeah. And also, I feel like it's a great place to put in your writing time with fan fiction.
Yeah.
That's also a very good place to, you mentioned it earlier, but I feel like that's a very good place. I mean, this is not to say I am the hill I will die on is the fact that some of the best writing I've ever read is fan fiction. Mm-hmm. Like I genuinely life-changing pieces of literature. But also there are no gatekeepers to fan fiction, which means that you can also get people who, not to throw Wattpad under the bus, but go on Wattpad, and I myself am an AO3 connoisseur from a live journal legacy. So it's my relationship with Wattpad is, I assume it's just children over there having fun. But it's, you can get through trying stuff out, figuring things, starting writing small stuff, writing your first massive long story.
Yeah, your first like 120,000 word character art. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you, were you writing fan fiction as well as reading it? Was that something that you were using to hone your craft at all?
I think I actually did something like one step nerdier than fan fiction as my
incredible
main. Yes, I love fan fiction, and I have a lot of friends who write fan fiction still, and I love it and I gobble it up. What I really got into was role-playing back and forth, writing with another person, and that's collaborative storytelling element. Just, I loved it. That, I absolutely adored it. That's where I really cut my writing teeth, was writing back and forth with other nerds.
I feel like the top version of nerdiness for that is if you were playing an original character that you created within 100%, the world.
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
Just, I took like one look at you and I was like, that's someone who's roleplayed an OC on a
guilty
internet
charged
forum.
Yeah, guilty. And like, they were, some of them were the most cringe things that I can. I remember my first role-playing character, and I will not tell anyone her name because I'm sure that you could Google her. But this started out the most cringe with this beautiful straight-sized girl with long blonde hair, and then ended up writing characters who looked like me. And it was this wonderful place to explore that and be able to, because there aren't any gatekeepers, there aren't any actually folks to police how you're exploring and telling stories. I got comfortable with myself because of role playing, and I'm really glad that I got to do it because it gave me this safe space, much like D&D, much like watching movies, to explore my relationship with identity, whether that's my queer identity or my identity as a fat person or a neurodivergent person. And yeah, role playing forever. I would still, if somebody had a good game right now, I would jump into it. I'm not even going to tell you a lie.
Here's the thing. Role playing online on the forums as a character, is that not just D&D without dice?
It is, absolutely. I actually found forum role playing before I found D&D. And then so when I started doing D&D, I was like, oh, I know how to do this. I'm an expert.
Easy peasy.
Yeah, easy peasy. Yeah, I don't have to write 5 pages in Word of just the most ridiculous drivel. Yeah. So yeah, it is the same kind of vibe and I'm all for it. I'm just a big role.
Oh my God, I love it. Unless you have anything else to say about 10 things, I would love to hear your fourth pick.
It's actually this is a great segue because my fourth pick is because of writing like fanficky kind of thing. My fourth pick is Ever After, the Cinderella story with Drew Barrymore. Yes. Much in the same way, around the same time that I was having my cringy Shakespeare phase, I was also having my cringy Renaissance Festival phase.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as soon as I saw Ever After and Drew Barrymore's character, Danielle, I was like, this woman gets, because she's smart and she's like counterculture and she's all of these wonderful, cool, rebellious things. And I was like, oh, she gets me. And then I just felt in a way that I couldn't put a finger on. I was like, this actress, we have something in common. And I knew it in my heart of hearts. And then a couple of years later, she came out as bisexual. And I was like, oh, okay. Oh. So yes, definitely. But the reason that I added this to the list is because it was the first time I had my own like headcanons of queer ships. I shipped Danielle, who was Drew Barrymore's character, and Jacqueline's character. Which, by the way, just a caveat real quick, how did we allow a generation of people to believe that Jacqueline was the fat, ugly stepsister? I think that's one of the reasons that I latched onto her as a character, because she was plus size and she was fat. But it was like that terrible 90s treatment of like fat bodies are disgusting and ew, like nobody could ever love this character. Teen Kristen loved that character. Teen Kristen shipped that character with Danielle. And that was when I first started like thinking about, it started out just thinking about stories like Prince Henry is boring. Like who, Danielle is way better than this Prince Henry character. What if Jacqueline has a much better vibe with Danielle? They have much better chemistry. What if they just left the wicked stepmother and had a little
ran away together
into a cottage in the woods, pre-cottagecore lesbian vibes? And that was like my favorite.
Watch that so hard. I mean, for those who haven't seen Ever After, what are you doing? It's basically Cinderella. Mm-hmm. And what's really funny about it is it's not even like a Cinderella story version of Cinderella where they've just modernized it and changed it. You're looking at it and you're like, we all know this is Cinderella, right?
Yeah.
It's set in the Renaissance era. All of this is giving actual Cinderella the changes. If I talk about the changes, it just sounds completely unhinged because it'll be like, she's friends with Leonardo da Vinci. Question it.
That's just how, and that is also a framework story. I had forgotten that until I rewatched mm-hmm. it. And it's set as like a, let me tell you the story of ever after. But yeah, no, just like truly... in the way that only I think 90s movies can be, unhinged retelling of Cinderella, like that invites you to imagine, what if Cinderella were a little bit punk rock in the Renaissance? Mm.
I had never thought about the two of them together, but now you've said it, I'm utterly convinced and also really stressed out because I just know that there is not going to be anywhere near enough fan fiction of that online. Yeah. But it was like, yeah, it was essentially talking about like one of the stepsisters and Cinderella functioning getting together. And the stepsister is played by Melanie Lynskey, who at the time was just an absolute like English rose of a delight. Like she just had this adorable little face, these rosy cheeks. Mm-hmm. Dark like hair, dark features, like she was an absolute stunner playing Jacqueline. But it was exactly that time within the culture of the like heroin chic size zero thinness, where anyone who you couldn't see the bones through their skin mm-hmm. could be cast as like the fat and therefore ugly but like character in a show. And this was like a classic one. I feel like America Ferrera in Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants as absolutely. Well was like another classic, or her in basically anything she was in many years.
Or Renee Zellweger also got that treatment, like with Bridget Jones's Diary.
With Bridget Jones, unhinged behavior. And I wonder if you can speak on your experience of fatness and your experience of sexuality and I guess like desire or attractiveness or like feelings in terms of like your own feelings of self-worth and the ways in which those two fed together, because I do feel like there's a lot of, especially people who were raised as girls, who where their experience of their own desirability and sexuality is very tied to how externally they think people perceive them. Was that something that you found affected you, or is that something that you were like aware of or rebellious against? Like how was that relationship for you, and how did it intersect with your queer identity also now coming into play?
This is where we get to the heavy portion of the program. Absolutely, that is something that I struggled with even until not too terribly long ago, because I feel like there's still so much space for straight fat women and femmes to have to get comfortable with themselves. And then you add this different layer of queerness, and like the way that I use my body is different, and the way that I clothe my body is different. And it has been a journey to come to loving my body as a fat body and as a queer body. At the time that I was watching this movie originally, I was still very, oh my gosh, she is fat and I'm fat and I look like her and this is bad and awful. They even dress her up as a horse for this masked ball. And so no wonder I had problems conceptualizing my body as like something that could be loved by anyone else. But I think especially in terms of my queerness, it has been, I had to undo a lot of internalized homophobia that was wrapped up in internalized fatphobia. My first girlfriend in high school was very straight size, was very thin, and just had a very different body. And was not always kind to me about mine specifically in relationship to my queerness. Was not always kind to me because I was a bisexual. And during that time in my life, there was, I think, maybe a pretty prevalent belief that bisexuals are faking it, or that we're not. We're just like, we're either on a stopover to being actually gay, or we're on a stopover to realizing that we're, quote, really straight. So a lot of really nasty stuff got tied up in my brain about my body as a fat body and as a queer body and my bisexuality as being not enough. And it has been through starting to write queer fat characters and allowing my characters to find love for themselves and love with someone else that I have been able to untangle some of that.
Yeah. Was that something that you were conscious of when you started writing, when you were really digging into writing as a potential career or something that you were working on more seriously? Was that like a conscious thing that you were trying to do, or is that something that you found subsequently as you were going through the process, or even afterwards, where you went, oh wow, I was doing something here that was not just having fun and writing stories?
I think it was definitely a realization that I came to afterwards. I've always been really passionate about, that's not true. I didn't start off as being passionate about writing stories about kids like me. I started off wanting to write stories in which I could be this perfect thin girl. I could be this like straight girl who had all of these wonderful adventures or whatever. And then it was only when I started in my like mid-20s exploring writing people like myself that I really got comfortable with, oh, okay, I can be that main character. I can have my main character moment. I think every time that I write a new story with a new character, I have one of those little retroactive realizations of, oh, this is what I was doing here. Mm. I am very lucky and I am so much more confident. I come from a place of self-love about my queerness and about my fatness now, but it has taken into my 30s to be able to do that. And what I'm hopeful about with my writing is that as I am learning these things about myself through my writing, that someone who is maybe a little bit younger or like at a different part of their journey can pick up a book that I write and realize that they don't have to wait till they're 30 to love themselves. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not relegated to the fat stepsister in the horse costume at the ball. And mm-hmm. I hope that I can bring people along for that journey a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I feel like you're going to have to be ready. You're going to have to be ready,
yes,
for you to be at a book signing, because there are going to be readers of your books who are going to come up and want to talk to you about that thing.
I spent the last week of my life doing a small book tour and had a moment. I might get a little teary about this. Mm. Just one of the librarians at the library, I was doing an event there, the library where I grew up going to like story hour and checking out all of my books, learning about all of my Shakespeare books and my silly Renaissance books. The teen librarian there, after we did this event where we got to roll D&D characters with a bunch of teens, amazing, she said, hey, before you go, I just want to tell you, you absolutely nailed what it's like to be fat and queer and neurodivergent in high school. And this is the book that I needed when I was a teenager. And I just want to thank you for writing it. And when I tell you, I was like, keep it together, Kristen, just keep it. This is a professional engagement. You got to keep it together. But I went out into the parking lot afterwards and I just cried. And I don't know, it is the great joy of my life to have moments like that.
That's so sweet. And also for me, it's like a joy having, we have all kinds of people guests on the podcast, but for me, it's like such a joy having writers and directors and actors who come on where I'm like, I have no doubt that if I was to do this episode with someone else X many years down the line, like your books, your movies would be the things that the guests were bringing to be like, oh, this was the thing that I figured this out. Or, oh, I'd worked out and my like mum gave me this book because she'd seen it in the store and was like, oh, I had a little rainbow flag on it and I thought it would be your kind of thing. That's what's so exciting to me, is that so many people are putting stuff out now. We have people who are doing the stuff online on the internet where they can just put out whatever they want. But we also are getting more and more of a buy-in from the traditionally more gatekeepy spaces that we would not have seen this kind of queer content for young people coming out a few years ago. And there are so many people in the publishing industry who are really pushing for that, because they know that, one, the number of people who are identifying as queer as each generation goes by increases, but also like how needed it is. Like my book, Hearing Queer, was essentially commissioned because they put out a book for boys, for queer boys, that my friend Riyad wrote, and they would have people on the book tour who would come to buy it, but they would be like, oh, but I would like, do you have one for girls? Or there will be people who'd be like, I'm like non-binary, like how does this apply to me? And like, it was really interesting to see that there were people within the industry who were like, oh, we see that reaction from young people and we want to respond to, we want to like actually be putting that stuff out in the world. So yeah, it's really exciting to see stuff as well that isn't just like about the misery of being queer, which is useful and has its place, but there's also these stories where it's, hey, there is queerness, but there's also like other interests, D&D, friendships, like all of these things that come into it, where you're also talking to those supposedly niche areas of queer youth, mm-hmm. who also have specific hobbies or specific interests that are going to just go absolutely mad for books like this, where they're like, wait, that's me, that's 100% me, and imagining themselves on the cover holding hands with their little boyfriend, girlfriend, general love friend that they can hang out with at comic cons and be like super nerdy with is really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. I would love, how many more picks do we have?
I have one and a half. My final pick is embarrassing.
I decree that no cringe is allowed in the episode. Okay. Everything is perfect and cringe doesn't exist.
I'm okay with cringe. I think that is something that I have learned as an adult. Embrace the cringe. It's okay. This is the most cringy of all. And I'm gonna caveat this with, I like it for not the reason that I think a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
Twilight.
Twilight has been having a bit of a renaissance moment.
Absolutely.
So much discourse about it, so many people talking about it, so many people rewatching and rereading it. So I am fascinated to hear, what is the reason you think, and then what is the actual reason why you would be nominating this?
I think that the number one reason that most people would guess is Kristen Stewart.
Super very valid. Fair, yes.
Absolutely valid.
There was actually, so there's another version of guest episodes for those who've listened called Hot Takes, where people come on and they have to give us their queer movie hot takes. And if you would like to go back and listen to my friend Connie's episode, it is one of the hot takes that they come with is the hot take that Kristen Stewart should have played Edward in Twilight. It was like the least expected Twilight hot take for the episode, but I was fully convinced. So now when anyone mentions Twilight, I can only think of how cool and hot Kristen Stewart would have been as like the emotionally constipated vampire twink.
I'm there now. I'm there now.
On board.
I have to go back and listen to that, because that is absolutely my kind of, that's my kind of stuff. The reason that it impacted me, other than I love vampires. So other than just being trash in peak Twilight craze between the books and the movies coming out and all, and even in the Twilight Renaissance, the thing that clued me in is that I loved watching the movies. I loved reading the books. I absolutely did not want what Bella had, because Bella has this like super heteronormative journey from finding the most toxic man in the room to marrying him right out of high school. And I knew that I did not want that. And again, I come from the American South. I come from a place where drag is being banned. There's all kinds of terrible stuff in regard to silencing queerness. And it felt, in teen and early 20s, Kristen, just thinking, I don't want this. I don't want this perfect little get married, have a weird little demon baby life. Just thinking that felt incredibly rebellious. And that was before I was even super comfortable with my queerness. I had this phase, bless my heart. I had this phase where I was very actively queer. Like, I had girlfriends. I was going to the gay bar all the time. Like, Thursday night, ladies night. Like, going to drag king shows all the time. But I was just a really passionate ally, okay? Like, I just kissed girls because I was a really passionate ally. But not because I was just, like, the token funny straight friend with a girlfriend. And so I wasn't even comfortable to say things like, I am bisexual, I am queer, I am non-binary. But I knew that I wanted out of that script. And even just realizing that felt really powerful to a younger version of myself.
I think this is the first time we've had someone on the podcast for these episodes essentially give an answer which is like, I saw this and was like, ooh, no.
And
I must have the alternative, which I guess is being queer.
Yeah, and it's not even like queer was the alternative. It was just like, not straight is something that I'm not interested in. Or that straight is not something that I'm interested in. And I don't know, just like realizing like this kind of gives me the ick, clued me in a way that things like somehow kissing girls didn't make me understand. Oh, okay. Like, this is not just like I think Rita is cute. This is something about me is different. And for better or worse, Twilight was part of the vehicle that was part of the ride that I took to get there. And I'm lucky now. Like, I have this wonderful life that does not look like that and is delightfully queer and like unexpected and wonderful, but it took a little bit of breaking up with these like really toxic heteronormative ideas that I had. And cringe or not cringe, Twilight got me there.
At the time, was when you were figuring this out, was this like as it was, you were saying it was like during the craze, during the mania when it was first happening? I don't know how old you were then, but was there a sense of not just, oh yeah, I'm not really into this, but also considering how into it so many other people were, of like alienation from your peers, or that it felt like it wasn't just like I don't want this and that's okay, but I don't want this, what is wrong with me element of feeling?
Yeah, for sure, because I had a lot of, I was in my like late teens, early 20s when we were in peak Twilight, and I had a lot of cishet friends who were like, oh my god, it's so romantic, it's so wonderful, and I was just not connecting with the text on that level at all. I was not connecting with that, not to yuck anybody's yum obviously, but I thought it was just not the vibe for me. and definitely had moments of, okay, if this is not for me, then what's wrong with me that makes it not for me? And it took a lot of weird to get to, okay, maybe it's not something that's wrong with me, it's just something that I am, and that's fine. But definitely felt isolated from some of my more twihard fan friends.
Have you rewatched the movies at all? Is that something that you've been, this sort of renaissance that's currently having, have you been involved with that at all? Or are you, you know what, I did my time,
Madeline. Yeah, okay, here's the terrible truth about me is that yes, I have. And I was an English major in college, and I love to engage with a text that I don't actually like. Mm-hmm. And Twilight is one of those for me. Something that has come up for me more as I engage with it as an adult who is in my 30s is like how, this is maybe a little bit of a hot take, how abusive it is. Because that is something that has come up in my adult years. And now one of my favorite things to do, because, and I think that not just with Twilight as a movie or as a book, or like other, a lot of other movies and books around that time had this sort of like paradigm of, I'm not like other girls. And the boy that I love controls me. And it is now my great joy to flip the script and say that I am exactly like other girls. I'm exactly like other queer people. And my friends and my partners love and adore me and accept me for who I am without condition. I just, that again feels radical to me to be able to put that out in media.
I couldn't have put it better myself. That is also a very amazing goal that immediately is, I simply gotta go out and buy every single one of your books the moment that it drops. If that's gonna be the vibes, I'll take it. You said you had a half left, one and a half.
Yes, this is, so I was thinking back about movies that clued me into, okay, maybe there's something else going on here. I have a very distinct memory of going to Blockbuster, which for those not in the know was a video rental store in the United States in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And I remember seeing over and over again the video box for But I'm a Cheerleader.
Yep. Yep.
And I can just see Natasha Lyonne's face on the cover and thinking like, I have to watch this movie. Like, I have to know about this movie. And I my mom was like, you can't watch that movie. And I just did it. I never got to watch it. But I always remembered that VHS box cover. And I finally made time in my life to watch it last summer. And if I had watched it when I first saw it in Blockbuster all those years ago, I would have been so clued in so much earlier. Love that movie.
I love that as like a, you know what, if we went back in time and you just launched a VHS of it at your own head back in time, maybe this all, you would have changed the fate of humanity. It would have been different.
Yeah, I would have saved myself so much bad fan fiction and like crying and weirdness. Just absolutely loved it. Wish that I had interacted with it more beyond just really knowing that what was ever in that VHS sleeve I needed to know about.
I cannot believe that we've already reached the end of our time together. This was absolutely flown by. I'm also obsessed with all of your recommendations, and I'm 100% going to rewatch Ever After. And also I've realized like a really good companion to that movie is Ella Enchanted.
Yes.
Which feels like it's got similar, there's also like a kind of sapphic romance that you could definitely build into that one, and it's got a little bit of a retelling but still in the version of the Renaissance Europe. So I feel like maybe I'm going to do a double bill of that just as a reward for a hard day's work tonight. That feels absolutely like a good way of spending my time.
Can I add a third recommendation to that little list?
Oh yeah, please.
Catherine Called Birdie. It's a newer
yeah,
yes, it is really
Ramsey.
Good. Yes, that was another one that I was obsessed with at that age. Yes. And definitely gave very, this is a book for queer girls vibes. This is a movie
and they're
for
so
girls.
Good in it, and they yes, there's definitely some perfect. That is our official recommendation for everyone who's listening now. Whatever you're doing, maybe you've just finished your commute in the morning into work, leave, turn directly around, go back home and watch those three movies with some snacks. Thank you so much for joining. It's been amazing. If people who are listening would like to find you online or your book, like what should they be looking for, searching for?
Oh yeah, you can find me online at my website, bykristinrandall.com, on most social medias at bycrandall, and you can find my book, The No Girlfriend Rule, wherever you like to buy books.
That's it for another episode of the Queer Movie Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast so you are primed for our next episode in your podcast app of choice. And if you really like what you hear, then please consider supporting us over on Patreon, where we have some very fun perks to offer, including monthly queer movie watch-alongs on our Discord. Thank you very much. Goodbye.